Let me tell you about Public Square. There are several lines that meet other edges.
Youth of this country who are already in a disillusioned, disenchanted state will be encouraged.
Where we talk about the fine margins. Sometimes it's black, white, and blurry.
It's also informed by the need to save costs and reduce legislative time.
Then there are the actors right at the center, coming through political processes, which could be dramatic.
To the extent of this man, if Parliament does not rise this morning.
And controversial.
If driving through the roads is a getting the macabre, compatibility is that of government.
And there's you to help connect the dots from the top to the bottom. Join Rotimi Sankore and Arogo Obo at the Public Square every Friday from 4 p.m. to 6 p.m. 99.3 Nigeria Info.
Ladies and gentlemen,
this is the Public Square.
Right, and shaku maku, everyone. It's Public Square. We continue discussions after ideas to look at a big, big, big issue. 16 days happens everywhere of activism to end violence against women and girls. And this is happening from the 25th, which was yesterday, started. We run all the way to the 10th of December, which is coinciding with International Human Rights Day. And a special guest today is Osayo Jigu. She's the country director, Amnesty International Nigeria. It's always a pleasure to have Osayo Jigu join us for big, big conversations. Thank you very much, Osayo.
Thank you too for having me.
Excellent. And thank you very much for the great work you do in protecting and showcasing where rights have been abused. And even when sometimes a criticism, you still continue with the work. Amnesty has just published a special report titled A Harrowing Journey, Access to Justice for Women and Girl Survivors of Rape in Nigeria. And Osayo will talk to us through the report, and afterwards, Rotimi Sankore will provide some perspectives on the impact of gender-based violence on individual society as a whole, look at how it impacts the economy. Again, thank you very much, Osayo.
My pleasure.
Right. So this problem we're dealing with is massive. And it's enough for, I've seen the executive summary of the report. Uh-huh. And I'm sure people also too want to have an idea the magnitude of the problem we're dealing with before we can then talk about how we can find a way through this dark tunnel.
Thank you, everyone. And it's really an epidemic, as we chose to describe it, because the issue of rape is not something new to our legal system. And during COVID-19 lockdown, the issue of gender-based violence increased, and everybody was asked, what can we do about this? A state of emergency was declared for GBV. And so at Amnesty, we said, oh, let's even take a stock of, you know, what's the state of the law? And we realized that for many states in Nigeria, they're still relying on the old laws, the criminal code and the penal code, in terms of definition of rape, in terms of the punishment for perpetrators, but also the fact that many victims and survivors, when they approach the legal system, are not getting the support that they need. So that's part of the reason why we did this research. And it was shocking for us to find out the figures that we got from the National Human Rights Commission, for example, that 11,200 plus rape cases were brought to their attention. So this is the National Human Rights Commission. This is not the police, right? Mm. The police had not shared any figures to us as at the time we went to press. But during the first 3 months of the lockdown, the police had come out to say they had handled like about 700 cases. Just the 3 months of 2020. And the National Human Rights Commission said to the best of their knowledge, 11,200 cases were brought to their attention. Mm. So this tells you that in a country where we are also very conscious about our image and about our children and about family values, the numbers however shocking they are, are still largely underreported. Is the state of affairs that we have. So our conversations and interviews with survivors now showed us why it is so difficult to get justice for them and why these cases are going to continue to happen. But more importantly, how the system is failing the people. Because 11,200 cases, how many got prosecuted? Let's even look at that. It was shocking to find only just a handful of those cases, whether it's with the police, whether it's with the National Agency for the Protection, for the Prohibition of Trafficking in Persons, NAPTIP, and other bodies, NCDC and all of that. You right. find that prosecution of this offense of rape is almost, you know, impossible.
And it's a very important part of the discussion, especially access to justice and just why it's almost impossible for the police to lift their game in ensuring that those who have been abused or violated can get access to justice. What does your report show about this? That's access to justice and what law enforcement is doing to become a major trigger for change to happen.
The law enforcement is a major trigger for change to happen because they are often the first contact. So when a crime has been committed, people go to the law enforcement agencies, often the police, to lodge a complaint to ensure that they can get the alleged perpetrator arrested and to begin the criminal process.
Right.
So, but what we found in the research is that there's a gap in resources.
Right.
So survivors could be asked to provide money in order to fuel vehicles. Meanwhile, the police should have been empowered to provide this transportation, even to take the survivor to the hospital and to find the perpetrator and arrest the perpetrator. They should be able to provide a safe space for survivors to share their experiences.
Right.
Sometimes survivors have been embarrassed by the line of questioning, or they are questioned in a place that is intrusive without taking into consideration their privacy. But one good thing was that at least when the victim is a woman, they ensure that it's a female police officer. So that is really good, that they ensure that it's a female police officer that does the investigation and the examination. But you find that it tends to be intrusive. They don't explain to the survivor what they are doing, why they are doing it, what the issues are. We expect law enforcement to assist the victim and the survivors in terms of filing a complaint. But there were cases where they could be advised that, especially when it involves a family member or someone known to the victim, like a neighbor or a friend, to see how they can solve it outside of the justice system, instead of encouraging and supporting the filing of criminal proceedings against it, because it needs to be a complaint, which is then filed. Although, technically, because it's a crime, the police does not need the consent of the victim to go ahead. The crime has been committed. It's an offense against the state.
Right.
They should go ahead. But we find a situation where there could be active encouragement of the victim and the victim's family to drop these cases. Also, about telling them about their rights. These are the rights you have under the law.
Right.
It was not so, you know, common in many of the cases that were brought to our attention. And this is crucial. If
right.
we're going to see any change in terms of access to justice for survivors of rape,
right.
the police, especially the major law enforcement agencies, need to be equipped with the tools to do this. And right now, they are struggling, and it's affecting survivors from getting justice.
Absolutely. In case you just joined the conversation, 99.3 Nigeria Info, we're on to Osai Ojiro, who is the country director, Amnesty International in Nigeria. And we are looking at 14 days of activism, violence against women and girls. And this began yesterday. It's going to run all the way to the 10th of December, where we have the International Human Rights Day. And it's what we do every year. And this year, Amnesty International Nigeria has done a report, and that report is the basis for the discussion this evening. And it's harrowing having to do this, because these are lives that have been involved. Many of these lives now have been scarred, and we hope that they can get help. Unfortunately, many of them cannot even get access to the help that they need to get their lives back on track. But we hope that the little we do here, we'll be able to show some light on what the real issues are, and then people, whether state actors or non-state actors, can begin to make things happen for their betterment. Well, what would you say? The exactly. worst case, yes, oh, sorry, the worst case, some of the worst cases you want to highlight and bring to the attention of the audience that you did get through during the course of this report?
So the worst cases were those involving girls. There's a case of one of the survivors who spoke with us. She was raped when she was 12 and got pregnant for her rapist. And she had to carry that pregnancy, give birth to that baby. And she knows who the perpetrator is. The perpetrator is a neighbor. And she's not been able to get justice because her case, she was one of those who was invited back. After she identified who the person was, it turns out, in the circumstances, it turns out that the man must have spoken or, you know, got into some sort of agreement with the police and they let him off the hook. And then she was threatened to name someone else, an unknown person, as the perpetrator of the crime. And every day she knows this man exists, is working free. And she's also carrying a baby, you know, that she has to look after. Her education has been impacted. And it was shocking to hear her story, to see how strong she is as a person and how she just wants this man punished and to prevent him from doing this to other girls and women. Another case was of Karen. Karen was in boarding school here in Abuja, and she was rushed home when she kept having this illness that didn't, this fever that didn't subside, and she couldn't walk. And it was in trying to find out what was wrong with her that they discovered a used condom in her, and it caused sepsis, which then eventually led to her death.
Oh dear.
Unfortunately, the family has been trying to get information from her school in terms of what could have happened. Who could be responsible, especially because it was a boarding school. So at what point did they know she was missing? What were the issues? Sadly, she was so sick when she was taken to the hospital, she did not speak. And by the time they discovered what it was, she could not explain what had happened to her. She had gone into shock. And eventually she died. Because at least if she had named someone or somebody, then they would be able to track her. So when you hear the stories of this teenagers who are barely, you know, fully developed and their life has already been snatched away from them, you begin to ask yourself, why is the system failing our children? Why are we not facilitating access to discovering the truth? Why are we training these girls to be silent? Right? Because she must have known what had happened to her. She was sick for days and everybody just thought it was a fever. What kind of threats did Karen experience? And so it's one of the cases that Amnesty has brought out a petition. We want to get as many signatories as possible so as to force the Attorney General, to force the police to actually carry out an investigation into Karen's death. And on that point is the fact that there were some cases that came out in 2020. We have the case of Uwa in Edo State. Till date, nobody has been held to account. Barakat, who was raped and killed in our home. So even in cases like that were, you know, popularized because of the shocking circumstances of the women's death, why is investigation so hard? Why is finding the perpetrators difficult when we survivors have closure? And when will families be able to move on? Because this, the trauma is not only for the survivors, but also for the victims' families. Mm. How are they able to cope with this situation? And this is a conversation we hope the government authorities are listening and should be willing, based on the commitment they made with the declaration on state of emergency on gender-based violence, to do. We don't just want the rhetoric, we want the action. We want to see people who have committed these heinous crimes to be brought to justice.
Absolutely, and the report does suggest, and it does show also too, there's a strong correlation when people do this sort of thing and are punished. It serves as a deterrent, and it also helps people get through the grieving process and the healing process. Ozai, what would you say that in terms of the people, you know, we often say the wheels of justice does grind very slowly, and it does grind even way slower here than in many other parts of the world. There are so many, you've just mentioned a handful of cases. There are several unresolved cases, you know, that haven't seen the light of day. Many of them stuck in the rot in the investigation stages. Some even haven't gone past the investigating police or IPO's notes. What has been recommended to be done with this sort of cold cases?
Well, in the first instance, it's a priority that the system gives to these cases. Because of the kinds of evidence that is required and the fact that victims get re-traumatized if they have to keep repeating their stories. Mm. They've repeated it to the police, repeat it in hospital, repeat it in court, repeat it again when they are being cross-examined. Mm. I think a lot more should be done to fast-track these cases. And also, there have been suggestions about special courts. Maybe that could help, because also with special courts means you will have judges, prosecutors, defense lawyers who have been specially trained to bring those cases and to handle those cases in court. But we need the system to prioritize women's issues. And that's why having significant events like 16 days is important, because it's like reminding the government, gender-based violence is huge. Violence against women and girls in particular is a menace. And you need to prioritize it, you know, and fast-track these cases so that they can be heard. There's also a tendency that when cases stay too long, people forget, you know, what had happened. Evidence could be contaminated, especially in our communities where we don't have the preservation of evidence, which often is bodily fluids of the victim, might, you know, get lost, might not be tenable. We got to know recently that even the DNA labs that exist, the forensic labs that exist, they are still struggling to be used to their full capacity, because people don't think about forensics when they're thinking about building the evidence for prosecuting rape cases. So if a bit more attention can be done to prioritize these cases when they are listed in the record, when you have DPOs of police stations being able to say, okay, do we have any rape cases reported, and fast track the prosecution of those cases and the following up with the Department of Public Prosecutions, I think there will be a bit more conscientious and diligent prosecution in the process.
Absolutely, and we hope that they do that as quickly as possible. In case you just joined again, just to remind you, it's 16 days of activism against violence and girls and women. This is going to go all the way from, began yesterday, will go all the way till the 10th of December. And we have the country director of Nigeria Amnesty International, Osayo Jigo, who's going through a report which was done by Amnesty, and it gives us, and like she's been pointing out, the state of affairs. It's an epidemic, which apparently there haven't been much inroads made. We're going to break. When we come back, Osayo Jigo is still with us. She'll be looking at many of the cultural norms and stereotypes, unfortunately, which have worsened the situation. We hope that we can see opportunities there also to help improve the situation. 99.3 Nigeria Info. Osai, we're going to go on a break, and we hope when we come back we can continue from where we stopped. And then if you've got questions for Osai, comments, go on WhatsApp 0809-597-5805. We'll intersperse with discussion also too as they come in. Please stay with us.
Ladies and gentlemen,
this is The Public Square.
Oh, welcome back. Rather long break, but thank you very much, Osai Ojingo, for staying with us. And in case you just joined, 99.3 Nigeria Info, we are closing in on this interview we have with Osai Ojingo, Country Director, Amnesty International Nigeria. 16 days of activism against violence, women and girls. They've done the report, Access to Justice, a harrowing journey for survivors of rape. And that's women and girls. And Osai has been going through a number of important points with us. Cultural stereotypes is where I was going to ask you before we went on the break, just how this is such a huge problem and what we can do about it.
There's a lot of, I would say, cultural, both traditional and pop culture in terms of women's behavior and what is acceptable male behavior as well. There's a lot of myths flying around there in terms of how women and men should conduct their relationships with one another. And the most damaging of all is the stigma that women face because of their sexual activities. So when a woman says she's raped, there's no doubt that sexual activity has taken place. Otherwise, why are you crying rape? And there's a tendency for victim blaming and victim shaming when women do report these incidents of rape, especially when it's with someone that is a boyfriend, an intimate partner, a boyfriend, a spouse. People are like, oh, but if you guys are already in a love relationship, or you're already familiar with each other, then they cannot be raped. But that is wrong, because rape is about a sexual activity that takes place without consent is rape. And that is the narrative that we need to start emphasizing so that people understand why we need to make that shift. It's always important to seek consent before we engage in sexual activity. And what is also quite relevant is because the myths are perpetuated, even pop culture, like I said, you find that a lot of movies, music come out that are very suggestive. And I remember there was a time when there was, you know, people came out to say, you know, stop sexist jokes, but most importantly, stop joking about rape. Rape is not a joke, because people feel, oh, it is just one of those things, and that it's a sign of a masculinity's power. And it's showing off, and it's actually something to be encouraged. So we want men and boys to behave appropriately. We want women and girls' rights and bodily integrity to be respected. And it begins with challenging and breaking down these stereotypes. In our report, we highlight five facts which people often, you know, miss about rape. And one is that the most common forms of sexual assault occur with people that are known to the victim or survivor. You know, there's this fantasy that, oh, rape is committed by some, you know, serial rapist, you know, stranger rape. But the most common are from someone that they know. The other fact is this issue about, oh, the reason why we have to be careful about allegations of rape is it could be false. Rape is something that is so invasive that it's difficult for someone to come out to say this is what happened to me.
Right.
And this has led to people not believing survivors. But there's no evidence that that false rape reports are as common as it's made to believe as a result of some stories that have been amplified. And there's always that fear, oh, there could be one story that could be missed, but false rape reports are actually quite rare. Another issue, and this was also captured in our report, is there must be some violence. Oftentimes, victims of rape do not physically resist. Not because they don't want to. Like I said, it could be someone that's in a position of power, someone that they know.
Right.
But also there's this psychological impact that when an assault is happening that causes the victim to freeze. And in one of the interviews, a survivor explained that when she brought the case to the police, they said, oh, there's no, since there was no torn pants and no torn clothes, there was no way they were going to, you know, file a report on rape. So this idea that there must be some violent attack and some torn clothes, or there must be some visible injuries and there must be signs of resistance for them to believe the person did it once the act was committed against them, is another, you know, means that makes it difficult for people to believe rape victims.
Hmm.
Then this idea that the victim must have brought it upon themselves as a result of what they wore.
Mm.
Or when you be wearing mini skirts, when you wearing tight and feeling clothes, this has provoked someone. This has caused the man to lose control. So they kind of justify the rape, which is also wrong, because what women wear is not the issue. And we've had cases of young girls. So what exactly did those girls wear, babies, that could have warranted the kind of sexual assault they experienced?
Right.
And finally, the fact that, you know, you're at a party, you're having a good time, there have been cases of people that have been drunk. And we've made it quite clear, being drunk is a state of mind where you cannot be held to account to have given consent to sexual activity, especially when there have been cases of people who have been drugged as well. So challenging this myth and correcting it using the facts could be one way to, you know, push the narrative in the favor of the survivors.
Right, and we will get the opportunity to look at other recommendations overall as we run out of time. But help us understand, toxic misogyny is something that has been mentioned in this report, and help us understand the ramifications and just what exactly you mean by toxic misogyny.
So it's about, in simple terms, it's about people's attitudes to women's emancipation and women's ability, women's agency. So when I say women's agency, it's women's ability to choose.
Right.
So misogyny says, you are there for my pleasure and you are there at my convenience and I grant you access. So, and it is toxic because it just belittles the woman's existence and treats her like a second class person. And for us to move ahead, even the law enforcement agents, the lawyers, the judges, the nurses, the medical personnel that come into contact with survivors of rape need to unpack their own ideas of what a proper woman or proper behavior is, or rather treat the person in front of them as a human being requiring assistance.
Very, very important. And we'll get to the important part also too, which has to do with the recommendations and sort of way forward. With this report, Access to Justice, and looking at the harrowing experience survivors of rape have to live through. If you ask in a summary, Osai Ojigo, what sort of recommendations you've put forward, what will they be?
One is to strengthen the law and the use of the law. The Violence Against Persons Prohibition Act reformed our understanding of, you know, the crime of rape, but not every state has domesticated it. So it would be good for all the states to do so. But even for those who have, to implement those provisions, because there are sections that support for survivors. There are sections that state that the police, the investigating police officer, cannot elect not to pursue a case of gender-based violence like rape. Another is to put resources where our priorities are. The epidemic exists. For it to be stopped, there should be sufficient number of cases prosecuted to deter others from even thinking about it. That can't happen if the police are underfunded, if survivors still need to pay in order to access medical care, psychosocial care, and get the police to file their complaints. The other thing is more around the support for survivors. And this can be in form of access to more sexual assault referral centers where they can easily get access to care, and one-stop centers. One thing that was repeated often by the victims is that they feel humiliated each time they have to repeat their stories. Our processes need to be streamlined in a way that once they've shared that story and it's properly documented by one agency, then the other agencies should be able to rely on it. And finally, something that is even common, not only for rape, but for also victims of like gunshot wounds, victims of violent crimes. We want a situation whereby when you see a rape survivor, that they are treated first before asking for money, before any sort of thing. And you do not require a police report for you to give them evidence, medical report showing the extent of their injuries. We've seen cases where this has delayed cases, where evidence has been contaminated and which have affected the case because someone is trying to say, oh my God, you said it's rape, or police brought you here, so I can't give you the report. That practice needs to end. And our system, our justice system should be willing to receive reports from private hospitals and not limit the evidential quality that they provide. Because in Nigeria of today, if someone is armed, you go to the nearest medical center that you can get support. But we find that if it comes from private hospitals, they frown at, you know, is it real? Is it something we can use? Meanwhile, public hospitals are not that accessible. They're not available everywhere. And they still demand money too. So the question is, let's make it easier for people to report and document.
Indeed, easier for people to report and document. And we hope that by next year, when we do a compare and contrast of where we are today and where we will be in 12 months' time, we'll see some significant improvement in terms of the cases that have been taken in and the numbers of women and girls who have been sexually abused reduced significantly also too. Thank you very much, Osayo Jiwo.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Always a pleasure. Osayo Jiwo, Country Director, Amnesty International Nigeria. And we look forward to the next report and where we can have some big, meaningful conversations again. Thank you very much, ma'am.
Have a lovely day.
And you too, a great weekend. We're going to go on a quick break and we come back. Rotimi Sankore will be up and that will be right after the news headlines, where we have a 360 and a big picture, and then continue and get reactions also to from what Osayo Jiwo said, the interview we had. It's 99.3 Nigeria Info. This Public Square, we'll be right back.
Let me tell you about Public Square. There are several lines that meet other edges.
Youth of this country who are already in a disillusioned, disenchanted state will be encouraged.
Where we talk about the fine margins. Sometimes it's black, white, and blurry.
It's also informed by the need to save costs and reduce legislative time.
Then there are the actors right at the center, coming through political processes, which could be dramatic.
To the extent of dismal if Parliament does not raise this money.
And controversial.
If driving through the roads is a getting the macabre. Compatibility is that of government.
And there's you to help connect the dots from the top to the bottom. Join Rotimi Sankore and Aroho Obo at the Public Square every Friday from 4 p.m. to 6 p.m. 99.3 Nigeria Info.
Ladies and gentlemen,
this is the Public Square.
All right, 99.3 Nigeria Info, and Shaku Maku to you, everyone, as the Public Square has reopened again. And from now till the top of the hour, we will continue the big conversation. Like I said earlier on, 16 days of activism, which began yesterday, and will continue all the way till the 10th of next month, which is the Human Rights Day. And we did begin discussions. Well, Square actually opened up with ideas. I will be looking at the NSAS panel report. Being expected, the white paper, together with the original documents, which were handed over to the governor of Lagos State nearly 2 weeks ago. And then Osayo Jigo, country director, Amnesty International Nigeria, looking at a report, Access to Justice, which highlights the harrowing experience of survivors, that's women and girls who go through rape, and many of the issues around that report. She talked about them, and I see a number of your comments on WhatsApp. WhatsApp again, 0809-597-5805. Rotimi Sankore, data analyst, data and development expert, I beg your pardon, as well as co-host Public Square, has joined in. And we'll do a 360 on this, as well as a big picture on what this means and the impact. Rotimi.
Hello,
great, and we are here again.
Yeah, I mean, it's sad every year. This 16 days of activism against violence started, I think this is the 30th one now. This is the 30th year. And I was quite happy when it started, because some years before it started, myself and some friends and associates, male and female, had committed ourselves to the struggle for women's rights and equality, including ending violence against women and girls. And a few years later, 30 years ago, when the first one of these 16 days took off, we were, I don't want to say happy, because violence against girls and women is something that shouldn't be happening in the first place. But we recognize the importance of a global campaign. However, it is sad that 30 years on, this is still continuing, although more people now recognize it for what it is, and I hope more people are joining the struggle. And we hope that very soon it will not be necessary, or it will be minimized.
Right.
You know, in the same way that the Atlantic slave trade ended.
Right.
So, you know, the open trade in black people ended.
Right.
Racism, we are still struggling with it, but at least the open trade in black and African people has ended. We hope that soon that we'll only have the, you know, some fallout to deal with, but not this industrial scale.
Absolutely.
Sexual violence that still continues. And I'll explain why I say it's industrial scale. But first, let me recognize the significance yesterday of the two young ladies that we are first and second on the I Beg to Differ
debate.
Debates organized by Nigeria Info as part of its 10th anniversary.
Right.
Really, really good initiative by Nigeria Info and its management.
Right.
Significant prizes given to the young ladies that won. The first one got ₦1 million.
Right.
The second got 250,000.
Right.
And they got computers, gadgets, and I'm sure many people watched it yesterday, which is why I'm coming to it. As I listened to those very, you know, extremely intelligent and articulate young girls. One was 13. I mean, one is 13.
Yeah.
And one is 12. And I, you know, I just thought to myself, can you imagine the horror? Can you imagine the horror if those two extremely intelligent girls with great potential had been captured by some idiot somewhere, supported by false culture and a state that does not recognize the rights of girls, if they had been captured and subjected to a lifelong, horrible experience of sexual violence in the name of forced child marriage. And, you know, just reflecting on that and the millions of girls, not just in Nigeria, but globally, that have to go through this horrible experience. You know, I mean, you watch that debate and you are almost crying for joy that these two girls don't have to go through that. But you are also sad that there are millions that will be subjected to a life of sexual violence and their entire potential extinguished. Their entire potential extinguished. So I'm really happy for the two young girls yesterday. Absolutely brilliant, absolutely intelligent. You know, looking at them, I just thought, you know, the poor boy that came third. You know, yes, you know, would have been wondering, right. Because I'm sure the poor boy had been indoctrinated to feel that boys no more. Yes, in all likelihood,
yeah.
In all likelihood, only to be stunned by two young girls. So congrats to them. Yeah. But that's the point I was making.
All right.
About the industrial scale sexual violence that is still going on in our country, that millions of girls of that age are taken and subjected to sexual violence for life. Because when you are taken at 11, 12, 13, not only you have no say in that matter, when you are captured and your will is broken at that age, effectively the gangster fellow has captured you for life. And with a situation where in Nigeria, where the Nigerian states or the state governments are not playing any active role to rescue girls that are like that, that industrial scale sexual violence continues.
Absolutely.
So why it is significant that Amnesty's report focuses on individual cases. We must not forget that this is still going on at an industrial scale. And it is really that commoditization of girls and women, that culture that is allowed by the states as cover. That is what makes it easier for individual girls and women to be violated.
Right.
Because if the industrial scale one is prevented and stopped, and girls and women are not treated as commodities, then the individual cases will be impacted. Because a lot of men that grab girls off the streets or assault them after tricking them into places,
right,
whether it is falsely luring them for job, as you know, the girl in Calabar or the girl that was reading in the church in Benin that was sexually violated and murdered,
right,
or as I mentioned, girls that go to social gatherings and then they are drugged from there. Those things will be reduced if the states recognizes that violence and sexual violence should not be tolerated in any form at all. So that's my opening statement before we before we come to the talking points.
Absolutely. And how time flies while we have this discussion. But already several of the talking points, you've already touched on some of them. And I'm going to do something so that we can benefit the audience by having look at what exactly our thinking is on this based on the talking points, and we can sort of touch base with most of the talking points. There's one of the talking points I think will connect directly with what Osai said, which is wrote to me the state of prosecution of violence against women They've seen no improvement whatsoever. Don't talk of even less than significant or significant, which they say is directly correlated with solving this problem, or at least making some inroads in this problem, which you say industrial scale, which she says is also an epidemic. What would you say has been, especially with rape, the key problem with prosecution?
Well, all sexual violence is rape. Like I said, on the industrial scale, when the state legitimizes it and they claim it is marriage, that means the rights of the girl have been nullified because she has been successfully captured by some guy who claims that his culture or religion allows that capture. So that, in the eyes of the state currently, it nullifies the rights of the girl. And therefore, she is not even categorized as a victim of rape in the eyes of the state. But in any moral universe, a girl that is captured and forced into marriage, sexual violation, is rape. Now, those cases, the police is not looking into it. And those are millions of cases. So we need to recognize. Now, the kind of cases that Osai is talking about is the individual type of atrocity that is not openly legitimized by the states. In other words, if you are caught in those circumstances, the attitude of the state is, well, you were caught. If you can be successfully prosecuted, so be it.
Right.
Now, I underline successfully prosecuted. That's the point you are making there. The problem there is that the patriarchal state as presently constructed still sees girls and women as commodities. And therefore, the law enforcement is not organized or budgeted for in a way that these cases can be successfully prosecuted. Let us start with the IPOs, the police officers in charge of the investigation. Are they trained for forensic investigation? I mean, can anybody confidently walk into any police station in Nigeria and be confident that if a girl suffers sexual violence and rape, that the police officer allocated to that case has the capacity for forensic evidence? Can we say that? No. So if the police is the arm of the state that is supposed to start the investigation and the prosecution, and the police officers, mostly male, are not trained for forensic investigation, we can't even get past stage one. Now, the training aside, is the equipment there? Because you need to collect evidence.
Right.
You need to store the evidence and you need to use the evidence. So, police station where, first of all, they don't have the forensic rape kit to start with to collect the evidence. Then the police station has no lights to store it. So you can see stage by stage how that problem accumulates.
Yeah.
I have said ad infinitum for the past 20-something years until the budget of the police includes a budget line for forensic rape kits, or in fact, forensic kits for any type of violence.
Right.
The prosecution of that case, the chances that such a case will be prosecuted successfully is close to zero. Because look at any of the cases in which there's a prosecution going on. It is only in instances where the fellow was caught red-handed, like the fellow that lured a girl, for a fake job interview.
Right.
In Akwa Ibom or Cross River, I think it's in Akwa Ibom.
Right, Akwa Ibom.
And he was caught red-handed. Now, in any other case, like the case of Uwa in Benin, the girl who went to study in a church, because there was no library in the community. No library where girls can go and study in safety. They have to go and improvise. And any opportunist just monitors them and thinks, ah, okay, she's going to come this night. And when she comes, we are going to ambush her. Because I bet you that that who attack was unlikely to have been one person. Now, in that kind of case, was did forensics come into play? Did the investigating police officer get the evidence and say, okay, who are the men that would have had access to that place where she was? Was DNA evidence taken from everybody that had a key to that place or that would have known, that had access to the compound where she was reading at night, and say, okay, sorry, gentlemen, we need to establish, you know, what is happening here. Can everybody please give us a sample? And then we match it to the sample taken from her body. Without that, we will just be shouting on social media, justice for Uwa, justice for Uwa, justice for Uwa. The police will swear that, in fact, the fellow will be captured soon. The governor will weigh in and say that, in fact, he is giving the police an ultimatum that within 1 month, and that will be the end of that matter. The budget is being defended now at the National Assembly.
Right.
Has the police been called to say, excuse me, Mr. Inspector General of Police, sexual violence is the biggest crime against women in this country. Where is your budget line?
Absolutely. Now that you mentioned, Rotimi, the budget and you know, how it affects individuals, we probably also look, before we go on this break, on the impact of this violence on women and girls, on individuals, societies, and the economy.
If I may make one more point. So the last problem there is, in the judiciary, are the judicial officers trained to be able to address forensic and use forensic evidence? So never mind the shortcomings in the police, the training, the equipment, the forensic kits and things like that. When this gets to the courts, have our judicial officers been trained? No. I happen to know that it is no, because I have interacted with them in situations where they were undergoing training for related issues. And I asked senior judges, and they said, sadly, no. This is not routine, and it should be. So within those three steps, that is why OSAI's report, the Amnesty report, found zero progress. So that answers that question as to why there is no successful prosecution. Now, do we have time to go into the impact of it, or at least we can start?
Yeah, we can start. We go about two minutes more before we, yes.
Okay. So first of all, the key thing to understand is violence against women and girls is not an end in itself. It is a tool of suppression. It is a tool of subjugation. It is a tool of social control of girls and women. And the dehumanization that is manifested in sexual violence is an extension of that. So if you are faced with threats of violence in your personal life and space, that can control everything that you do. If you are told that by some guy that you have let into your life that you cannot go and walk, and that if you have the effrontery to try and go and utilize your qualification, whether it is primary, secondary, or higher institution, that you'll be beaten black and blue, the chilling impact on it is that the actual violence or the use or the threat of the violence has been used to control you and your behavior. So that is what everybody should understand, that the dehumanization, the commoditization of girls and women that is what that violence is designed to achieve. So that's in the personal space. In the larger society, the larger impact can be on the economy. It can be on conflict. Those 14 million children out of school that President Obasanjo mentioned yesterday,
right,
which you talked about,
yeah,
on the Global Review Big Three.
Yes.
Most of them are girls. Most of them are girl children that have been prevented from going to school. Now we know that if girls complete 6 years of primary and 6 years of secondary, 18 years, they are more likely to go on to higher education. And that while they are in school, the chances of being forced into industrial scale violation in the name of child marriage is reduced. Now, where that does not happen,
right, Retemi,
what happens is that they are forcibly impregnated,
Retemi,
to the
go.
Extent...
So, sorry to interrupt, Retemi, but we're going to have to go quickly on this break. And we come back, we continue from where we stopped.
That's fine. It's commercial radio.
All right, let's go.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is The Public Square.
All right, welcome back, and thank you for staying with us on the Public Square 99.3 Nigeria Info, and we'll try and make the best use of the time we have left. Rotimi.
Yes, well, I think I should just try and wrap on the point I was making so that we can hear from the audience.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so I was saying we are talking about the impacts of violence against girls and women. And I was making the point that sexual violence and the overall violence has a chilling impact on girls and women. I mean, that's the means to the end, to put a chiller. So if you look at the young people on the I Beg to Differ yesterday, the 13-year-old girl and the 12-year-old girl that came first and second,
right,
for the most of their life under the current status quo, they will be looking left and right, you know, about what they do, where they go, how they, you know, their academics, can they go and read in the library at night? When they finish, what kind of jobs can they take? You know, because predators are after them. Whereas the 12-year-old boy that came third will have no such worry. And even though at this point, the girls at least have demonstrated a little more brilliance than him, by the time they are between 19 to 25, under the current status quo, the boy will more likely have more freedom to make headway with his potential than the girls. So in the personal space, that's the impact. On the social scale, I was making the point about sexual violence and conflict, which is that on the one hand, the majority of the 14 million President Obasanjo was talking about that are out of school children are girls. But the impact of them being girls is that when they are captured and violated, and forcibly impregnated to the tune of 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, sometimes 11, 12 children each. And when you multiply that by polygamy, in other words, one man can be responsible for such forcible impregnation,
right,
leading to 24, 28, 32 children. And no schools are built for those children. What happens is what Obasanjo was talking about, that they become potential recruits for bandits and extremists. So that is where it starts to have an impact on society and conflict. And in countries where such things happen, the participation of girls and women in the labor force becomes seriously reduced. And the overall impact is that there is more poverty in such areas. So in Nigeria, you can see anywhere such things happen on an industrial scale, there is more poverty. The same thing globally. So that's the impact in your personal space, in society, in economy, in conflict, and so forth. Look, I mean, this is a one-day discussion. If we want to go, you know, point by point on everything. But before I stop, so that our listeners and callers can engage, share experience and perspective,
right,
let me just appeal to people. If you're a guy listening now, this is a decision you have to make. I invite you to take the decision that some of us, men and women, took 30-something years ago to fight this violence against girls and women. It's, you know, it's an ideological decision you have to take. It's a principled decision. It's moral and it's ethical. And unless all of us do it, this is going to continue. So while on the one hand, the patriarchal state is not doing enough in terms of law enforcement, because if you see countries where the state has been recovered from patriarchy, that is where women have more ability to flourish. In countries like Nigeria, where the state has still been captured by patriarchy, women are crushed and reduced to commodities, and the state does not do enough to protect them. So it's a decision people have to take at an individual level to do this advocacy, to ensure that the state plays its role to protect girls and women from all forms of violence, including sexual violence.
Absolutely. And Rotimi is right. There's never enough time to talk about this sort of things, but that's why we've got 16 days of activism. And Nigeria Info will do this every day. At least you will have to hear and must do something about it.
Well, it's every day forever.
Yeah.
16 days only concentrate some activities to highlight it.
Right.
But it is every day forever.
Absolutely. Right. So let's go to the phone lines now. Number to call, 0700-993-993-993. Again, 0700-993-993-993. And then the female line, 0146571190. Again, 0146571190. Hello and good evening.
Shaku Maku.
Hey, Maku Shi.
It's MI from Makoka.
MI, great to have you join us. Please go ahead.
Good evening, Professor. Hello, good evening.
How are you?
Hello, good evening.
All right, MI, Rhythmic can hear you clear. Go ahead.
Okay, Makoka, you see, when the fish tells you that water is wet, who else do you want to hear from? And so you have said it all, only for us to summarize. Mm. But what you said is very instructive. Is that violence against women has not only been sanctioned by the state, but recognized under the guise of culture and religion. That must be emphatically said. Do you understand? Because if your culture says that underage girls can get married, then the state has sanctioned it. Do you understand? So on one part, you are fighting underdevelopment, yet you are sanctioning through culture. You know, the biggest threat to development is not even the lack of maybe like insecurity now. We are not looking at guns and bombs. We are looking at these kind of things. Do you understand? It's not by budgeting $10 trillion to fight Boko Haram. No, you are effectively making a breeding ground by making your children give birth to children, basically. So I think once you start having honest conversations, you know, this is what I mean. It's just brilliant information. Thank you so much, Mr. Rotimi Sankore.
All right. Thank you very much, Emma. Have a great weekend also, too. Hello and good evening. Can you put out the device you're listening to so we don't get the feedback? All right, she's off. Hello and good evening.
Hello, good evening. This is Alex. Good evening, Mr. Rotimi.
Alex, great to have you join us again.
Good evening.
Yes. You see, if you listen very well to everything that your guests speakers have said, you will find out that there are a lot of decisions that our politicians are taking, which should not be. I don't mean any respect to our, I mean any disrespect to our politicians, but the truth is that there are better brains. We can set up economic development teams. In fact, it doesn't have to be teams. A single national economic development team can do the thinking because they understand the issues involved. You see, security insecurity is affecting farming. Farming is affecting health. It's affecting education. You see, the politician's brain is not wired to take care of all of those kind of things. But in Nigeria, these are the people taking serious decisions in all of those areas. And there is something fundamentally wrong with that. And that's why we'll never address. Look at Sirica is really is pushing for Nigeria Airways. I mean, sorry, National Carrier. The other one is pushing for this. The other one is pushing for that. Another one wants to take off subsidy. She wants to give out 5,000 naira. Everything is disjointed. If we had an economic development team thinking through issues and solutions by themselves, then we'll have a better country.
All right, Alex. You know? Thank you very much. Alex says disjointed, knee-jerk reactions everywhere. Let's take this last call and then we take it from there. Hello and good evening. All right, that doesn't count. Hello and good evening. All right, one more time. Hello and good evening. Hello and good evening.
Ah, finally, Chief Obo.
Aha. This is Makushi.
Yala. Sorry to me. Good evening, sir. Well, I want to thank every one of you.
Right, Christopher.
People blame at the doorstep of the police and the judiciary. Chief Obo, I have a daughter. She was 12 when my wife died, right? But by God's grace, by next year, she will be 19. I monitor her and I make sure some certain area she doesn't go. There's a street in my area called Waleko. I dare warn my daughter, don't ever step on that street. The woman who she's learning trade on from, the day my son called me, Daddy, Mommy Leko send Uju to Waleko. I call the woman immediately. Madam, don't ever send my daughter to this street. So prevention, parents should do that more. Parents should monitor their children. I noticed a girl within her, and I called, I don't want to see this girl around you anymore. So prevention, please, because for the judiciary and the police, they are not helping matters. They are giving soft landing to these people. Even where they get the evidence that this happened, they will still be looking for proof. You just wrote to me now. The police don't have facility to do this. The judiciary don't have facility to do this. So the best thing is prevention. For me, it really worked out for me. Thank you, Chief Obo.
All right. Thank you very much, Christopher. Okay, so Ruth, we're out of time, but I guess we have time just to say.
Well, this is a matter that has to be fought until the end. When that end is, we don't know. Is it in 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, 50 years, 100 years? I mean, it's going to take all of us joining in to make it happen sooner.
True.
So all we can say is urge everyone to join this struggle to end violence against girls and women.
Absolutely, join to end this. And we'll be back again next week. And don't forget, you can listen to previous episodes, including this episode of Public Square on 99.3 NigeriaInfo.fm. Just go to listen again, and there you see the podcast of this show and several other shows which have always kept you engaged. We'll be back again next week, and then we'll have something very important to talk about. And we go on a break, and when we come back at the top of the hour, it will be time for the news. And after the news, Ifeanyi and Sammy will be here for music and moments. Stay with us on 99.3 Nigeria Info.